Hi, and welcome to another episode of Inconvenient Chats. In this episode, I sit down with Professor Markus Kröger, who has spent the past two decades researching the political economy of deforestation, resource extraction, and global development, with extensive fieldwork in the Amazon and other parts of Latin America. The topic of deforestation is particularly urgent today because scientists believe the Amazon rainforest may be approaching a tipping point. To me, this raises the question, if we know we're getting so close to the danger zone, why has reversing deforestation proven so difficult, or at least seem so, and be so slow? This is what I asked Markus. Together we discussed the findings he has made when traveling on the ground, what interests and mindsets keep us stuck in those deforestation patterns, and also what more positive alternatives he sees. His research was, by the way, published last year in a book called Clear Cut, and it's available online for free. You can find the link in the show notes. And as always, if you have comments or topic recommendations, you can write to me at kaisa@inconvenientchats.com. Please give it a listen, subscribe, and leave a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope you enjoy the episode. Markus Kröger, thank you so much for joining me today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
We have lovely birds singing in the background from your side. Can you tell me a little bit where you are?
Well, I'm in southern Karelia, eastern Finland, in the countryside.
That's amazing. Is that where you're based full-time?
No. I used to, when the COVID-19 started, we moved in here and lived most of the time here in the countryside. And nowadays we spend like the summers here. So some relatives living close by. So
that sounds wonderful though. Markus, you're a professor in global development studies at the University of Helsinki. And for over 20 years, you've been studying and researching land use politics, especially forestry and deforestation, both in Latin America and in Finland. That's probably, I guess, like a too short of a description of all the things that you've been doing, but would you maybe want to give a few sentences on how would you describe the central themes of your research career?
Yeah. So first I started studying business, and then I thought that's not broad enough. So then I broadened to Latin American studies, which touches on many issues, culture, society, history, environment, geography, and then finished my PhD in world politics. I studied sociology and political science at UC Berkeley, and then finished my PhD on the conflicts between the pulp investments, the large Finnish paper corporations expansion globally, and especially their conflicts in Brazil with the local indigenous people and local communities, social movements. So I've been studying this kind of like impact of social movements on these investment politics. And then for the postdoc, I studied also these issues in India, comparing Brazil and India, and mining, forestry, natural resource politics. And then after that, studying a little bit of the Finnish mining boom as well, and Arctic issues, and then the Finnish forestry issues. Now recently I finished a new book on the different driving forces of deforestation that explain deforestation in the Amazon and in Finland and globally.
Yeah, so you came out last year with the book called Clear Cut, The Political Economies of Deforestation, published by Cambridge University Press. And there you studied and compared to different patterns of deforestation. Was it Brazil, Peru, and Finland?
Yeah. And the focus was kind of like the different deeper processes and economic sectors driving deforestation in their own ways and clear cutting. So I studied the kind of ranching and soybean business in the Amazon, and also this kind of like illegal land grabbing, land speculation, how that is like the key explanation for the deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon. And then gold mining, open pit gold mining, which is very destructive socially and environmentally. I mean, in Peru, for example, you can see from the satellites the large open pit areas. And then I studied also the, you know, Finnish industrial forestry and its focus on clear cutting, which is kind of like a forest removal because you remove the natural old growth forests and then you have like single species plantations instead.
Wasn't it also that with this latest book, you've also spent a lot of time back in Latin America on the ground?
Yeah, I've been there every few years for longer periods of time. So in the Santarém region, for example, in the eastern Amazon in Brazil, I've been in total for about a year or more. And I've been to many different places in the Amazon. For example, with the journalist Mika Mäkeläinen from the Finnish broadcasting company Yle, we traveled over 2,000 kilometers from Cuiabá in Mato Grosso to the Santarém by the freshly paved highway, 163. So I was doing field research and he was doing reports there on the way. And that was in 2019 when there was the Bolsonaro time and there were these fires lit by those land grabbers and so on. So quite intense.
Mm. Yeah. And I guess that was indeed the time when deforestation of the Amazon was very much back in the headlines again during the Bolsonaro mandate. And then we had Lula back in office and people were kind of hopeful that that things would go better again. Let's just take a step back and set the starting point first here. I think we all know that deforestation is not a good thing. And, you know, how trendy that is on the list of trends that kind of goes up and down. But you had a really good point of why study of deforestation is actually particularly important right now. In the introduction of your book, you write that the focus of deforestation studies is no longer deforestation, but the potentially imminent breach of global and regional climate tipping points. Can you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, so the Earth system scientists, the planetary scientists who are modeling the global climate, they have found that there are like kind of 9 global climate tipping points. And these are like tipping elements like large forests, like the Amazon rainforest is one of them. And for example, Carlos Nobre, who is kind of like one of the founders of this theory, he has said that if you cut like 20 to 25% of the forest, then there will be an irreversible process of forest loss, forest dieback. So you will have
in
more
the
grasslands
Amazon.
In the Amazon. But that will affect the whole global climate and ecology. So you know, like it's global, it's not just regional impact. And then you have others like the Greenland ice sheets or the permafrost or the Antarctic ice sheets and also the boreal forests. So you know, if you reach a critical threshold, after that there will be no return. It's like a point of no return. So it's a completely different dynamic. We are not anymore talking about deforestation, so you cannot compare the current deforestation figures to what was there in the 70s or 80s. Because we are already now at the 20-25% limit. So in the COP30 meeting in Belém in the end of last year, Carlos Nobre said that we are almost there. So we should be very careful not to cross that because then the dynamics will no longer be linear, but they will be chaotic.
So what would happen if we go past that tipping point is that the added deforestation would not only be the cleared land, but there would actually be a kind of like a trigger snowball effect of the forest just starting to dry out on its own.
Yeah, so the thing is that these are like cascading impacts, accumulating impacts. So after that, it will be much harder for the forest to regrow and there will be much more drought. There will be all kind of extreme events and there will be like a process where not human actions alone, but the process in itself, the element in itself, the tipping point will start to kind of eat out the forest. So you know, it can happen quite fast even and it's very hard to reverse after that point, you know. So I'm studying now in the current project these reforestation possibilities, and it's quite difficult for many reasons already now. So the dynamic is such that it's kind of like then feeding into also the other tipping points. And it will have effects, for example, especially the precipitation, the creation of clouds for the whole southern cone of South America and the Amazon. And, you know, the more you deforest, the more the hotter it gets, the less wet it gets.
Then. Yeah, in other places as well. And those are the regional and international consequences that you were referring to.
Yeah, I mean, it affects it directly affects, for example, the decrease in Indian monsoon rains when you have the Amazon tipping point. So there's like these impacts that go in the upper, atmospheric currents that affect the whole globe. So that's why these are called global climate tipping points. They are not just regional and so on. And of course, there are differences between the regions. So some parts of the Amazon have, like in the southeast of the Amazon, they have already passed the tipping point. So they have already these large-scale soybean plantations, endless soybean plantations where they used to be forests. So they have already become like kind of grasslands. So they have no longer, it's already beyond the tipping point. So this is not only something that is going to happen, but in some regions it has already happened. But if it happens for the whole element, then the large parts of it will be turned into kind of grasslands or even desert there where there are sandy soils.
And I can imagine that would also have massive impacts on the livelihoods of people over there.
Yeah, like for example, Tim Lenton, who is like a key scholar on these tipping points, he has said that most likely like the Sahara was a forest. Like they have found like trees underneath the sand there still 100 years ago that were used for lighting up fires, and probably there has been this kind of tipping point there of the forest turning into a desert like 6,000 years ago, not so long ago. Like you can still see from satellites the rivers and so on.
So the Amazon could turn into Sahara essentially?
Well, not exactly. I mean, they say that in some parts the forest would still remain, but anyways, it's like a huge catastrophe if the Amazon tipping point is breached, because that means then that the global average temperature will rise so much that also the other tipping points are breached, which will then feed into the other ones. So the worst scenario is kind of like a hothouse earth scenario where we will go back to a kind of dinosaur type climate when Greenland had like dinosaurs, it's like plus 18 degrees average, not like the plus 3 or plus 4 that they are saying, but much more, so there's like a lot of uncertainties, and these are like the worst case things. But so that's why it should be taken with utmost urgency and care.
Yeah, and you're saying that we are very close to a tipping point. In some regions already passed it. I guess then the reasonable deduction one can make from there is that there should be no more deforestation taking place in the Amazon. It should all stop right now. Where are we on that?
Yeah, it should stop now, and they should like stop these destructive investments. But for example, the current Lula government, they are still building, paving highways there to the Amazon, which is highly destructive infrastructural projects, although they have like increased like voluntary fire brigades presence there. And they have decreased the deforestation figures, but then like forest degradation, like selective loggings, they have increased. And then also the deforestation of the Cerrado, the large forest south and southeast of the Amazon, that's where the focus of deforestation is, and that's also problematic. But we should urgently focus on reforestation and agroforestry, ecological restoration, in the economic sense also. Because if you continue deforesting like this, it will be very harmful for the current economic sectors that rely on rainfall.
On the research that you've done, what did you learn about and reveal about why the deforestation keeps on continuing?
Well, these kind of sectors have become kind of like regionally dominant and some in some places hegemonic. It's very hard to resist them or say anything against them, because you have like, when you drive the highways there from Mato Grosso to Santarém, to Pará state, crossing the Amazon frontier, the deforestation frontier, you see a lot of like soybean silos there, very expensive machinery. Now they are introducing drones, which do the spreading of these agrotoxics, these poisons. And you know, then there's so many sunk costs there that the investments have to be paid back. There are a lot of debts. It's international. The system is international. Like the German Bayer company, they are selling a lot of the, and other companies from the US and Europe and China, they are selling the, you know, these genetically modified seeds in a package with fertilizers and agrotoxics, and they kind of mandate that you have to overuse the agrotoxics because they get more profits from that. So it's the profit logic that mandates there, where you have to make more profits, while it's not like wise for the environment or not even for the local producers who have to pay more, and to whom I've been talking and visiting them. So they are kind of also strangled in this current global system and setting.
Who are benefiting the most from it, and who are holding on to that power the most strongly?
Well, of course, you know, it all accrues mostly on the top, so the financialized global elites, shareholders and big decision makers and big financial capitals and those big corporations making decisions. But then, of course, you know, like there are like these big four, like Cargill, the American company, which is like having an export port of soybeans in the middle of the Amazon. But then you have also these slaughterhouses like JBS, the big, the world's biggest meat company, Brazilian company. And they have like these refrigerators in the Amazon, and they can like fatten the calves in the freshly cut, you know, forest areas where they put grass, and then transport the cows into southern parts and sell it as a Brazilian beef. And and then there are, you know, all the illegal land grabbers who speculate on the land. So they go into some place and they cut the forest and put fences there, put grass, put some cows, and then they falsify land ownership documents and then sell that land, and they make huge profits. So the biggest profits actually come from that land speculation. The cow business in itself is not so big for you know, those speculators. So that's like a particular subsector of the whole thing. These land mafias, they're kind of like land mafias. And then you have like other sectors, like it's the Amazon is currently like being very much taken over by organized crime, which is merging with the gold mining, laundering the drug trade money and other illicit activities money with the gold mines and gold from there, and transporting drugs and mercury, like and guns. So it's like there are a lot of entities that benefit from this, and they are looking at their short-term gains, and it's hard to stop it when, you know, you have those sectors in place when they become dominant.
So it sounds like there's a lot of system dynamics going on. And I think this was also something you studied. You named it, was it regional political, dominant political economies or so? You also contrasted the deforestation in Brazil, Brazilian part of the Amazon, and then in the Peruvian part of the Amazon. And can you tell me a little bit about that comparison? Because what I understood is that you found that the dynamics are actually not the same, although the forest is technically the same.
Yes. So that's like one of the insights I got when traveling in 2017 from Cusco by bus. In Cusco in Peru, by bus from the Andes to the Amazon in Brazil. So there's a new highway built there that, you know, it's like a trans-Pacific highway that crosses from the Brazil to the Pacific coast. And you know, on the Peruvian side, there's still much more forest. You don't see these large ranches there that are on the Brazilian side. And you can see this, you know, from the satellites. So I was wondering, how is it possible when you have the same road and you know, the same forest, and there's such a great difference in the land use, in the geography, you know, in and then I figured out that, you know, it's more like that these political economic sectors, they are like regional. They stop in the polity and political system boundary. It depends on the context. So in Peru, what has become dominant are these gold mining mafias. And they kind of control the land and steer the economy, and they have the most profit-making, and the whole system is kind of... It's like Peru is kind of like a mining country, the mining elites. While in Brazil, the biggest power holders is this big agribusiness and rancher, large landholder group that holds most power in the Congress. And they can also control most of the land and what's done with it in also in the Amazon. So that's the key difference.
It sounds like there's a lot of economic actors that economic activities and dynamics that shape the pictures a lot. How big a role do governments play? I'm thinking also back to the Bolsonaro-Lula comparison, which I think is something that is often raised in the headlines in the media, you know, when we're talking about the deforestation in the Amazon. How big of a role do the governments have as a part of this whole system?
Well, they also have a huge role, but their role is like more complex, because part of the state is actually trying to resist it. So you have progressive state actors whose mandate is like kind of like ombudsman to try to stop these illegalities. Like in Brazil, you have this federal prosecution service, federal prosecutors who have been able to stop with the help of the local community social movements, many, many large projects, investment projects, which would have been harmful. But that said, the problem with the Workers' Party or these like so-called progressive leftist governments has been that they have been able to build those huge infrastructural projects, which the private sector has had been unable to do on its own. So when Lula started his government in 2003, 2004, he started this project of economic growth and huge amounts of money was poured through the Brazilian Development Bank into building new highways, ports, dams and so on into the Amazon. And that was highly destructive. The building of the Belo Monte Dam had a huge impact in all around, and then the paving of these highways and creating these export corridors, these export ports. So without that kind of support given to this sector, it would not have grown. Now its power is much stronger than before Lula came to power first time. And, you know, now it's in the Congress also. And 2016, when Dilma Rousseff from the Workers' Party was in power, then this agribusiness part, it had grown so big that they then impeached her. They did like a coup, like a parliamentary coup d'etat, inventing some fraud that was not really there, or others were not punished for, and you know, so it had grown so strong that then they placed Temer and Bolsonaro into the power, who were even more beneficial to these groups. So you know, both kind of governments, both these far right and then these progressive ones, they have not really been environmentally minded. You know, they have been in different ways destructive for the for creating these deforesting extractivist sectors and power for them. So what I try to do is to look at these ultimate causes, look at the political economic power and how that explains how these things play out.
And then if we go back to what we're discussing about the global tipping points and kind of the global urgency of the consequences of deforestation, how much is there an information and knowledge gap? I think that's something that's often speculated, whether, you know, these things happen against people's best knowledge or whether they happen deliberately.
Well, it's not very much there yet. I mean, people refer to it in Brazil, if they even know about it, as the theory of Carlos Nobre. You know, it's like just considered as a theory. You know, there's still a lot of uncertainty, even among climate scientists. So, for example, in the COP meetings, there's a specific pavilion, like planetary science pavilion for these Earth system science people. But then there's a different for IPCC, for the other climate scientists. So even climate scientists among themselves, they focus on different things. You know, others focus on the tipping points. And then, you know, there's been some studies by other scientists saying that, you know, as a frame, the tipping point frame is not very good for policy changes, because many people get afraid. They say it's like doomsday talk. And that's, it's kind of like deterministic that there wouldn't be space for human agency. And they say that, you know, okay, if this is the case, so what's the purpose? So there are all these kind of politics around this concept. And I think many people have this climate skepticism, climate change denialism is on the rise again with Trump and all, and Bolsonaro in Brazil. But then also, like, even the common people, they, I mean, the people who live in the Amazon and the farmers, they know about it. They know about it, yeah. But openly, they don't admit it. And they even know that it's harmful for their rainfall and all. But, you know, it's so strong, this power of the regionally dominant political economic sector, that they just go on with it. And it's a bit of the same in Finland. Like, clear cutting is just continued, although science clearly shows that there shouldn't be so much clear cutting. It's bad for the environment, and it's bad for the climate, and it's bad for, you know, the local farmers' incomes. So this continuous growth forestry would be much better and cheaper in all senses. But still, it's continued because, you know, the pulp industry benefits from that, and the local people who, these consultants and companies who are like forest stewardship, you know, advisors, they advise local people to do that. And it's a bit of the same in Brazil. Like, if you want to get those GM soybean seeds and the agrotoxics fertilizer package, you have to, you know, buy into that whole production model, which is destructive. And it's very hard to devise alternatives for these people in those regions.
And I guess that's where it's also very difficult to break out from that as an individual. And then we also go back to, I guess you said you've been studying social movements before. And it's like, how do you kind of get to a critical mass that can kind of challenge the system and then maybe create some alternative models? But that can be extremely difficult.
Yeah, so there is a lot of resistance, especially the indigenous people who have their own territories. They are living in these kind of alternative spaces in terms of alternative social, you know, economic, cultural spaces, symbolic spaces, physical spaces. So, you know, they are resisting that process. And they are not afraid. Like, a lot of them are murdered because of their leaders are murdered and threatened because of that resistance to those economic interests. But then in Finland, for example, the difference is that there is such a huge hegemony that people are really afraid, many people, especially in rural areas, to speak out about that. They are feeling bad about the clear cutting next to their areas and so on. But they don't talk about it because those are neighbors and they are afraid of losing their jobs or, you know, community ties. So the hegemony is very strong due to the 1950s continued clear-cutting model where it's become like the habit of the country. So it all starts from this kind of moral economic background. So moral economy means kind of like the ways of production that are like accepted and normalized and how you should like organize the economic life.
In the book, you also mentioned some dilemmas that you observed. I found there was one quite interesting one with regards to Finland, how there are some forest owners who, for example, would be choosing clear cutting or choosing an option for their forest that would actually give them less compensation than the more protectionist or like the more conservationist approach. How do you then make sense out of that? Because we were just saying before that when you're living in a system where kind of like profit is the leading logic and that's what people then alert to, what explains this type of behavior?
Well, there's this kind of feelings that, you know, if you conserve the forest, like the state is paying for conserving old growth forests, so you could protect and get the same money and retain the forest, you know, which is nearby to your house. So it kind of makes no sense to, you know, clear cut if you get the same money from protecting it, and then you can still continue picking mushrooms and walking there and so on. But then some people have been like, they are thinking that then they would lose the ownership of the forest and they want to retain that forest land for their future generations, you know, their children as a heritage and so on. So it's a lot about control. But then there's also like a lot of misinformation being spread by the professional forestry journals, like, you know, that you would be forced to give out that, or even that people think that, you know, forests don't grow older than 100 years old. That when it's 100 years old, a spruce forest, you have to cut it. And that it would be even like beneficial for the climate, that then you plant new trees and it would be a good thing. So there's all these kind of like misinformation and these kind of post-truth discourses that then actually benefit the turning of these old growth forests into the such forests, which mostly benefit the this kind of practice where you thin the forest to get like a pulp wood and not the hard, you know, the not these sturdy logs that you create in a more thick forest for, you know, in a different kind of forestry method. But yeah, so there's like different kind of explanations for these kind of changes.
As you were saying it yourself, you went pretty deep into what are the root causes that are driving deforestation in different regions. Based on everything that you found now, what are the things that would need to change in the systems for us to be able to avoid those tipping points?
Yeah, well, there are many changes. So I think this moral economy is very important. Like people who are still living in the forest and from the forest and, you know, by the forest, they should be able to continue that way of life. So now, for example, in Brazil, there are a lot of these multiple use conservation areas and indigenous areas in the Amazon. But what, for example, the progressive governments have been doing, they have been expanding this poverty alleviation and especially the education programs there and expanding this Western-style schooling there. So then people were complaining to me, for example, in the Western state of Acre, that the kids don't have any more time to learn how to be rubber tappers, how to be like, you know, extractive populations who collect the, they don't know any more the trees because they have to travel 2 hours per day to a school in the city.
Yeah.
And then they learn the ways of the city. So they have been trained to be kind of like wage laborers in the urban markets.
Yeah.
And they don't have time to learn. And they said, we have to study about the polar bears, but the people don't even know what are the local animals here in the Amazon. So it's like that's kind of like a cultural violence of discontinuing these millennial practices and knowledge that people have on the forests.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of consideration that if you don't know how to read and write, then you are like stupid and you don't have any knowledge around the world, these peasants or indigenous people. I mean, of course, it's good to know how to read and write, but it doesn't mean you couldn't do that, but it has to be in a balance. So they have been developing curricula now that it's like including that forest-based knowledge, so that should be expanded. And there should be much more support given to the creation of the markets also for forest-based products, which are not based on logging the forest.
Yeah,
so you have
what
all
are those?
Kind of possibilities. You have all kind of possibilities for berries, nuts, all kind of cosmetics, oils. I mean, there's so much potential for medication, medicine and so on. Of course, those cannot be like patented by outsiders, but the locals need to really benefit from that. But it's very hard to create these markets when you don't have the finance and support from the state. So the finance currently, it practically all goes into these deforesting activities. So to be able to get a loan, you basically have to deforest and put cows there for the banks in the Amazon to give you a loan. It's very hard to get loans for these non-deforesting activities. And so on. So it you know, you have to change the rules of finance also, and then of course the regulation. You have to have much more police, a lot of, and especially the local people have to be given more resources to patrol and guard the forest, because the Amazon is so huge that only if the local populations are there, they can like inform where deforestation is happening, and then the local authorities need to go quickly there and enforce those rules and give more territorial autonomy for people. So there are a lot of things that can be done. We already know what those methods are, but it's a political issue because the governments and the parliaments are like controlled by those deforesting extractive sectors. So that's why it's not taking place.
But so if we're thinking in terms of, okay, now we know what needs to change, who has the power to change it, I guess state could play a big role, but then I guess then you need to have the interests represented in the state.
Yeah, so you have to kind of like co-produce the state or embed the state as a social movement and social actors, try to create new institutions that regulate these issues, change the laws, get more representatives there.
So state cannot be abandoned in the modern system. We are still living in like in an interstate system, and so on. And you have to also have a lot of civil society capacities and autonomy at the same time, so you cannot become co-opted. So that's even more important to be able to have these self-governance systems and territories. You cannot rely on the state support and shouldn't, because the regime can change quickly.
And are some of these things already in motion? You mentioned this one social movement that you encountered when you were studying Brazil. I would imagine there's a lot of things going on already. Can you give a few examples of positive examples of how people are organizing and doing things?
Yeah. So, for example, this Brazilian landless movement, they have also some presence in the Amazon. So they occupied an old oil palm plantation that had been there for some time, and it was failing because these monoculture plantations, they typically have some kind of problems. So that had like a disease that was ravaging the plantation. It was like owned by foreigners, and it was a large area, like 6,000 hectares, like 1.5 hours east from the city of Belém. And then they occupied that area, and they managed to get that land through this Brazilian constitution mandates that you have to give the unproductive land to the landless movement to settle families there. So hundreds of families moved in, and they've been now for 20 years, since 2004. They've been restoring the land. So the land was very degraded. There was a lot of erosion. There was a lot of ants because of the palm oil and a lot of use of agrotoxics. So a lot of poisons in the ground. So they have been reforesting that, planting first banana to get some natural fertilizer on the ground and shade, and then planting all kind of fruit trees, agroecological agroforestry in these socio-territorially just systems where, you know, people communally and by family base, they have like 10 hectares for each family plot. And now they have a lot of produce there. A lot of jobs. They have converted the palm plantations into like lush forest areas, and the forest has regrown in 20 years. It's incredible how quickly in the tropics and subtropics the forest grows. So if you go to one place and see trees being planted there, after 2 years it's already impressive, and after 4 years it's like quite tall trees. So it's completely different from Finland. So if you help the nature a little bit, there can be this assisted natural regeneration quite fastly, so it could be still done.
What do you personally believe in the most, and what gives you hope?
Well, I don't think the hope is the right category. You just have to work and you know, understand how these things work, and then you see the benefits, you know, seeing the different trajectories, the different choices that people make. And of course, it's never too late, although you have the tipping points. Well, if they are crossed, then they are crossed. That doesn't matter. You still have to be able to live. And then you just have to double down on the effort. You know, you have to plant more and devise new ways to, you know, capture the carbon and avoid these ecological losses. And yeah, it gives me hope to see that there are still these territories and these people who have this kind of capacity and understanding. And I kind of believe that there is still hope also to change in these broader systems, because it cannot continue like this forever. I mean, it can be already quite quickly that these tipping points themselves, these major changes, catastrophic events, will start to show to the producers that their extractivist, destructive forms of extraction cannot continue. That it's not profitable for them.
So then the profit logic could turn against the behavior itself.
Or that it's not even profit logic. It's just like misguided productive patterns. So, for example, in Finland, they have mostly planted spruce seedlings, and these saplings, like I think, like what they have planted in southern Finland, like here in southern Karelia, they will mostly like die prematurely. So they have cost a lot to plant, and because you have these beetle bark infestations already now because of the droughts, which are going to increase, I think like before 40 years, many of them will die. So the forest owners who have paid the costs of that planting will never get back the money. And so, you know, already now I see that they have become to plant more tree varieties. So pine, you know, spruce also like other, they leave some leafy trees there also. So it becomes not so monocultural. And in the Amazon, I mean, like the producers will start to feel the problems in the end of this year, in the end of 2026, beginning of 2027 is going to be very tough according to the current modeling. So there will be a super El Nino, stronger than ever. So it means that the drought will be even worse than in 2023-24. And more extreme, like rain in the southern part of Brazil. So a lot of crop losses. And I think then the food prices and oil prices will rise in the end of this year, beginning of next year, with the loss of the harvests and a lot of the trees planted now without irrigation systems will die because of the drought. So you know, the impacts will be so hard that the societies, they have such a like huge pressure that there will be a much more pressure for politicians to make some major changes. And I hope that this would carry on to actually changing the patterns.
Yeah. If you had the power to change one thing only, if it's an idea, a belief, or a structural dynamic, what would that be?
I think I would curb the access and power of the social media, of this post-truth networks, because I think that's a key part of the problem. Because, for example, now all these post-truth statements and this, like living in these alternative realities, they are really harming this issue, that this message from science and the knowledge from the environment, even it doesn't pass through, but people are like believing in these, you know, alternative facts, you know, and that's very harmful for in many ways also. I think that's the maybe the key issue, because I think before you tackle this issue of post-truth used as strategically, as a discourse and strategy, it's very hard to get across the message of these tipping points.
Well, that's a pretty good wish. We shall hope that we get at least in that direction. Markus, thank you so much for joining me today, and thanks for sharing your work, and thanks for doing your work. It's extremely inspirational and very very educational.
Thank you, Kaisa. And yeah, I think it's like very important this work you do, because it's part of this larger struggle to, you know, battle against this post-truth and, you know, all these alternative facts and these things in the media, that it's very important to have this presence there.